Welcome to Pathways, the podcast by Grenadian STEAM. Here, we dive into the journey of Grenadians and West Indian professionals navigating their careers in the STEAM fields, both at home and in the diaspora. We discuss their failures, their successes, and their moments of learning with the goal of exposing interested listeners to the depth and wonder that is a career in STEAM. I'm your host and president of GrenSTEAM, Arlene Hayes. Join us. Press that subscribe or follow button on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss a new episode. Ron Buckmeyer is the Associate Dean for Cultural Affairs and Professor of Mathematics at Occidental College, or OXY, in Los Angeles, California, where his primary responsibility is the direction of the General Education Program, with several other initiatives that report to him. Ron holds 3 degrees in mathematics, his PhD, Master of Science, and Bachelor of Science from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York. He's been on the OXY faculty since 1994, serving as chair of the mathematics department twice and achieving the rank of full professor in 2014, after beginning his academic career there as a minority postdoctoral scholar in residence. For a total of 4 years, Ron led the Division of Undergraduate Education at the United States National Science Foundation, or NSF, heading the Scholarships in STEM program and curating the Undergraduate Mathematics Education Award portfolio. In 2021, Ron co-edited the book Improving Applied Mathematics Education and has published multiple peer-reviewed articles in an eclectic collection of journals. He is a passionate advocate for broadening the participation of historically excluded groups, especially LGBTQ+ individuals and racial ethnic minorities in mathematics and other STEM disciplines. He serves the broader math community in several capacities, such as Vice President for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at SIAM, the Society for Industrial and Applied Mathematics. Ron is also a co-founder and board member of Spectra, the Association for LGBTQ+ Mathematicians and Their Allies. We hope you enjoy today's chat, and if you do, be sure to head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a review, or drop us a note on social media and let us know what you want to hear more of. Good morning, Ron, and welcome to Pathways.
Thank you for inviting me. Good morning.
Good morning. So to jump right in, tell me, what is your favorite or what would be your dream job? If money and education were not a factor, what would you rather be doing with your life?
I still think I would probably be in higher education, probably at an institution where that was larger, that was more students that were underrepresented, so I could use my skills to sort of improve educational opportunities for more students. If I wasn't in a job, I guess, I would be an author, writing books of some kind.
Fiction or nonfiction?
Definitely fiction.
Okay.
I barely read nonfiction.
Do you have a specific genre in mind?
Not really. Probably I like mystery and science fiction. I like to find books that can sort of cross between genre, so which is hard. So either bouncing between the two or trying to find some way to have them intersect.
Okay. Maybe one day.
Yeah.
All right. So Ron, you were born and raised in Grenada. Is that correct?
I don't think you'd say I raised in Grenada.
Okay, just born.
I was born in Grenada for sure. And then But then at age two, went to the United States. But then back at age 11 or 10, went to Barbados. And then I was in Barbados from age 10 to 18. And then went back to the United States.
Okay. So you've bounced around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about yourself as a student growing up? What were your drivers? What did you care about or not care so much about?
Yeah, so I was in the same echo of the British system, you know. So I was in, right, starting from first form. Most of the time I was in primary school. Well, yeah, actually, I was only in 1 year in primary school. So most of what I remember is secondary school. My favorite subject actually was chemistry. But I think that's because that was probably the best teacher. Math was always pretty simple. The thing I remember the most actually was, especially in Barbados, was that education was very, very important. So, you know, you get your, we call it your grade book. You know, we actually had a book, report book, where, you know, every single score, you know, in the class at the end of the semester was in there, and, you know, just random strangers would ask to see your report book. It's crazy. And it also, you get the score and sort of your place in the class. And so I was basically first in every class, except I think biology, because I could never figure out how to draw. And yeah, so I just remember that other people, other than, you know, parents or anything, would be interested in education. And so that sort of impressed on me.
Right.
How important education could seem to other people. So I think that might've helped me place an emphasis on it. But a lot of the time, there was no specific course or area I was most attracted to. Just, I liked chemistry and math was easy. I liked physics too, but I spent a lot of time playing chess as well during those years.
Yeah. And so you said you moved to the US at 18, I think it was. Did you also do like a community college in Barbados, or did you move right after secondary school?
No, I moved after doing, I did O-levels and then did A-levels.
Okay.
After the A.
So at any point in this time, were you seriously considering, you know, what you were going to do as a career after school?
No. No, I mean, I just went to college because, you know, my father had gone to college and just sort of expected. And it was very complicated. It was somewhat complicated because I was pretty sure I was going to go to college in the United States. But back then, colleges had no idea what O-levels and A-levels were.
Right.
So I did take the SAT and did very well on it. But admission to U.S. colleges is not just standardized tests, but it's also sort of like what activities you do and sort of grades in your classes. And I didn't apply to that many, but I didn't get into that many either. And so I ended up going to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And that was really sort of I always call it like a compromise between me and my father, because we went, RPI is a engineering school.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not interested in engineering at all. I was interested in math or chemistry. So I went to RPI as a physics major.
Okay.
And then almost immediately changed from physics to math, because I was in honors physics. And so in honors physics, they really stress the mathematical aspects of what's going on, but you still had to do physics labs, which I thought were horrible. enjoy those. So I knew I was not going to be a physics major for much longer.
Right.
But yeah, I immediately switched to math and did not look back.
Okay. And so you already had like a knack for math. It sounds like it came pretty easily to you.
My A-levels were in math.
Right. Okay.
My A-levels were math, advanced math, physics, and did I do chemistry? I don't remember. I think I did. I think physics, chemistry, math, and advanced math.
Yeah. Okay. And so when you decided to switch into the math major, was it kind of still just chasing, you know, what you're interested in, what you can see yourself studying, or was it starting to think of this as a future?
No, it was really just that was the most interesting subject. What I did find out, so complicated U.S. immigration story. My visa didn't come as soon as it has. So anyway, everything was fine. I was in the U.S., but because I adjusted my status from visitor to student while I was in the USA, that meant if I left the United States to go back home, then I would have to readjust at an embassy in Barbados Barbados. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like too much drama. So basically between holidays, I would stay in the US. Uh-huh. And so my first summer, I found out that you could do what's called summer undergraduate research, where they would pay you to work with a professor on, you know, some math problem. And I was amazed by this. Yeah, so that's when I realized that, oh, you can actually get paid to do mathematics. And yeah, that's a thing. And eventually that person became my PhD advisor sort of 2 summers later. And yeah, so that's...
Did you say 2 summers later?
Yeah, because I finished my undergraduate degree early. So my first year I did undergraduate research with him. Then my second summer I did undergraduate research with his wife, actually, who was also a professor. Uh-huh. And then the third summer I had to take 2 classes so I could graduate a year early. But then in the fall, I mean, I already been accepted to graduate school by then. And that's one reason why I sort of stayed at RPI, because I had my research advisors there who I'd been working with. And yeah, I knew the place, so I didn't see why I should go to another school. Even though I did apply and it got accepted to other places, but RPI, oh, that's another thing people might not realize. In math, when you go to graduate school, again, they pay you to do math.
Right.
You know, you in STEM, generally you get supported to do advanced degrees, master's or PhDs. Yeah. I'm always surprised by the number of students who do not realize that, because they always think about medical school or law school or I guess business school, and those are what are called professional degrees, and those are where the student pays. And technically in graduate school the student pays as well, but it's really the college gives you an amount that's equivalent to the graduate tuition,
right?
And then they pay you what's called a stipend, which is basically just, you know, regular cash.
Living expenses.
Living expenses, exactly.
Right. Okay. So it sounds kind of like this just happened, you know, like you fell into the research and you liked it and you continued. Did you ever make that conscious decision that you were going for the trifecta, 3 degrees in math?
Well, I mean, when I applied, I was planning on getting a PhD. The master's is basically just something you can get along the way when you get a PhD. There's sort of 2 different kinds of master's. There's what's called a terminal master's or different places you do a master's thesis, which is shorter than a PhD thesis generally. Or you do, like my master's is just a certain number of graduate credits. You have to do a certain number of graduate credits anyway to get a PhD. So that's why you get a master's along the way. And then PhD, you have to do more and then do your own thesis. And there's other requirements too, like you have to be able to read papers in foreign language. For some reason, I picked French because I'd done French in Barbados.
Okay. Okay, pretty interesting. So during this time, which part of math did you tend to gravitate to, or were you like really exposed to the full gamut of opportunities?
So as I said, RPI is a very engineering oriented place. So, and that's why switching from physics to math was not that big a deal. Actually, they called it, I think other places too, Department of Mathematical Sciences. And so the math department or mathematical sciences department at RPI is very applied. That means it is the kind of mathematical problems that you look at or the math that you use comes from and is directly related to actual real world situations. Though the, like my first research, the first research experience I had was just sort of playing around with some functions called hypergeometric functions that can come up in real world problems, but this was sort of separate from that context. The second summer was using math to, it was really computer programming, using mathematics and programming to visualize the hulls of ships. So she did research in waterways and design for the Navy to sort of make ships more efficient. And she was designing the ship hulls or the solving the math equations that would make them more efficient. And then she needed software to visualize what those shapes would look like. So that was interesting. But yeah, but the only math that I really was exposed to was what's called applied math. There's some people say math is sort of split into two different fields, applied math, and some people call it pure math. I tend to call it theoretical math, because if one side is called pure math, then the other side would have to be impure math.
Right.
So there's applied math and theoretical math. And I'm always interested in mathematics that comes from real world situations. So my PhD thesis, the research I was doing was, it's called computational aerodynamics. It was basically just using a computer to solve the math problems that result when you try to describe how fluids flow around particular objects or solids. And right. Often they're wings of some kind, but so the problems are related. It's like wing or water flowing around a boat. It's the same equation. Well, generally, but because water is different from the air, different things happen to the equations. But the idea is that they're hard. You have to use a computer to solve them. So it's the same thing.
Yeah.
In two different contexts.
And not very far off from physics.
Exactly.
Great. Okay. So you kind of found a way to merge the two interests that you had there. So after leaving or completing your PhD, what was the next step for you?
Well, especially in an applied field or applied math, often you go to one, or if not nowadays, it's almost two, it's called a postdoc position, a postdoctoral position, which is generally 1 to 3 years working with a professor who's your, we call it your postdoctoral mentor, and you're sort of doing research. So it depends on the place. Sometimes you bring your own research agenda and sort of collaborative, or you go and work with the mentor. The mentor has some kind of ongoing project and you sort of slot in. And that's, so I did apply, and that kind of work can happen at, you know, there's many different sort of research centers, or in the US there's government labs like Los Alamos or Lawrence Livermore or Oak Ridge. There's many government labs. So I applied to government labs. And then I also applied to the small liberal arts college in Los Angeles called Occidental, because they had something called a minority postdoctoral scholar in residence. And the residence was rent free. And it was in Los Angeles. So I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So I got that. And yeah, my advisor was not too pleased, because his other PhD students, yeah, had gone to government labs. And usually, so you do a postdoc or two at a government lab or a research specific place, and then you go to a college university to be a professor. But what changed over time was that previously, I mean, research is always important in academic jobs, but as time has gone on, teaching has become more important. And for example, when I was in graduate school, often, the reason why they pay you to go to graduate school is that graduate students often are teaching assistants for classes at big universities. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes, really, the interaction that students have, these classes can be like 300 students, and there's one professor and maybe eight graduate students. And right. then the graduate students actually teach the classes in small groups. But the value system was that research is always more important than teaching. And so I hadn't done any teaching at all. I did. Oh. I think I did one semester of teaching calculus while I was in graduate school. And nowadays that would be craziness because anyone who's going out to try to become a professor, we would expect them to have teaching experience, significant teaching experience, not right. only teaching experience as an assistant, but teaching assistant where they teach the class. Huh. And I did not have that. But the postdoc at the small liberal arts college was all about sort of getting teaching experience. And then, so it was like it was a teaching postdoc, research teaching postdoc.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
That was unusual at the time, but now they're much more common.
Yeah. And so that postdoc was at Oxy College.
Yeah.
Where you are still today.
I still am.
Yeah.
27 years later.
So something held you there. And you kind of just climbed the ranks a bit.
Right. Yeah. So, right. The postdoc was a 2-year position, and then they agreed to make me tenure track. Tenure is this process where a professor you get infinite job security, or in order to fire you, they have to sort of eliminate the department. And that usually happens after 6 years or so. And then about 8 years or so afterwards, usually get promoted to full professor. Yeah, so that's the academic. And yeah, it's Los Angeles, you know, it's a small liberal arts college. When I started, it was about 1,600 students, and now it's about 2,000 students.
Wow.
I like it.
So I've heard that you hold some pretty strong opinions about liberal arts education. Is that mm-hmm. accurate?
Strong opinions. Yes, I don't think they're unusual opinions. I think liberal arts colleges are valuable because they make sure that students are well-rounded. I mean, that was the thing. RPI is definitely not a liberal arts college. Mm-hmm. And I remember, not my roommate, but some of the other people in the residence hall had literally applied to RPI because that was one of the few places where you did not have to write an essay.
To get in?
Yeah, to get in, exactly. Mm-hmm. Did not have, right. And the, you know, the non-STEM parts of RPI are very small. I'm sure there's requirements. So, but at a liberal arts college, you know, it's really expected that you, like we say the Occidental degree is 1/3 your major, and then 1/3 what we call general education, and then 1/3 take whatever you want.
Yeah.
Which is pretty unusual because in lots of places have a general education program, but then the rest of, you know, it's like 1/3 or maybe a quarter is general education. And then at least half, if not more than half, and especially at an engineering place, would be required courses for your major. And then you might have some what's called electives, courses you can choose.
Right.
And some people would say that's good because, you know, if you're interested in engineering, then you should be taking lots of engineering classes. But, you know, nothing happens in a vacuum. The fact that you're an engineer still means that, you know, you're going to be working with people. You have to make presentations. You have to learn how to talk and communicate. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to understand how your creations impact the world. And so that's what happens at a liberal arts college. You'll see subjects and topics from different perspectives, maybe even the same topic from multiple perspectives. And also liberal arts colleges tend to be smaller, so the interaction between professors and students is more based on relationships as opposed right. to, you know, a larger place. It's, you're a number, literally.
Yeah.
You're desk number 321.
Yeah, I completely agree, to be honest. I went to a technical school, Illinois Institute mm-hmm. of Technology, mm-hmm. but I've always kind of seen, or even after that, I think I've seen the value of a liberal arts education just in that all-roundedness and the space to see what else you enjoy, you know, because
right.
I feel like once you get into a career, you're in it. For the most part, most people don't pivot out of, you know, their initial career. But if you have the chance to kind of test some other things, take a variety of courses, then you might find, you know, a niche that really fits you more.
Exactly. And lots of people, we said, well, maybe not. But lots of people go to college thinking, because you generally have to make a decision. It's like, the reason why you go to this specific college is because you're interested in a specific career or subject that resonates with you. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you're going to this particular institution. But once you go and you actually, it's curious to think about what people use to make that decision, because, you know, before you're an engineer, you don't know what engineering is.
Right.
You know, before you're a mathematician, you don't really know what you don't know what math people do. So you're making this decision based on sort of what you've heard or maybe you've seen from parents or some other model, maybe, or depictions in the media. And then you're actually doing the thing. And when you actually go there, it could be like, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be. And I don't like this.
Exactly.
So, or, you know, you find something that you had no idea even existed. And it's like, oh, that's really cool. And like, you might have had to take that course because it was fulfilling some requirement that you didn't even care about. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you realize, oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, that's why I think higher education is so important and exciting, because it's the period of someone's life where they're making these discoveries about themselves and about their own interests that will influence what the future trajectory of their rest of their lives is going to look like, for the most part.
Exactly.
Keep listening. We'll be right back after a short break. Here on Pathways by Grenadian STEAM, one of our key goals is to help expose students to the various career opportunities that exist for them, and to give them the resources they need to explore their own interests and forge a path forward. That's why we're offering current students and members the chance to join one of our podcast episodes to speak directly to someone who's currently working in a field they might be interested in. Searching for a mentor can be hard, and we want to help you get the answers that might just put you on the right track for the next step of your academic or professional career. If you think you or someone you know can benefit from an opportunity like this, send us an email to our team at pathways@grensteam.org. That's pathways@grensteam.org. Let us know what field you're interested in or who you would like to talk to, and we'll set it up. Listen up for student spotlights like this on our upcoming episodes.
And we're right back to the conversation.
So you have served as department chair, and now you're the associate dean at Occidental. How do you see the student experience, or how do you consider the student experience when you're shaping, you know, the math curricula at that university level?
Right. So students should be central at every university. They aren't always at Occidental, because we do have a, you know, 14-to-1 student to faculty ratio. I do think, and we do take teaching seriously as a thing. I think students are important. And so when I was department chair, one of the things that I did immediately, well, not immediately, it took a while because everything at university takes a while, was to change the curriculum so that more students could minor in mathematics, which is, you know, the area of emphasis that appears on your transcript. Generally, at our college, it's about 48. About one third. So a degree is usually 128 units. A major is between 40 and 50 credits or units. And then a minor is often in sort of like, you know, 20 to 28 credits. It's really, you're interested in this topic, they're related. You don't want to spend as much of your time as a major, but you're interested in, to a minor mm-hmm. degree. That's helpful because basically encouraging people to take more than one or two classes in a particular area.
Right.
And so if you're taking multiple classes, well then, hey, you might go, oh, I actually like this math stuff and let me just become a major. Or actually we have lots of double majors. So economics is the most popular major at Occidental, but we get many, many economics majors, math minors, or double majors, people who major in economics and mathematics, because they really go together, because economics is basically about, you know, applying quantitative methods or reasoning to the flow and description of money. I always think of economics as sort of physics for money, sort of using, instead of the real world phenomena, instead of using energy, you sort of use finances or money.
I've never thought of it that way, but yeah, even like lots of the charts and the flow charts you get, it's very similar now that you say it.
Exactly. So it's definitely a quantitative field. Mm-hmm. And so every department chair and or professor really, they wants to have more majors because you want to have more students in your discipline, but often faculty want more students, but they don't want to change anything about what they do to get more students.
Right.
They just sort of want the students to decide to magically come and do the thing that the way that the professor wants to do. But I realized that students are different than faculty members. We have to change. We have to be amenable and welcoming to the students. And it's different. I mean, it's a good question. I mean, now that I'm an associate dean, I see, you know, disciplines all over the college. So art history, you know, politics, sociology, psychology, mm-hmm. biology, and different disciplines or different faculty in different disciplines take different approaches to trying to encourage students into their classes. And it's important. Yeah. So I think it's the most important thing, students.
Very fair. And in addition to teaching, you've had several appointments, it seems, on the national level, mm-hmm. where you've had the chance to kind of influence student education outside of your university across the country. So in that experience, what do you take away as the student perception of mathematics? Because at least here in the Caribbean, you just hear a lot of, I don't like math, or you have really poor math scores coming out of schools, but what do you see as students' interest or lack thereof in the U.S.?
Yeah, no, it's, yeah, math needs a better PR.
It really does.
Because it's very strange. It's sort of baffling to me that people don't realize that, for example, the fact that we can use Zoom, the fact that there exists an internet and there exists, you know, video programs that allow us to interact in real time. That's all due to mathematics. And the fact that you have cell phones, that's all due to mathematics. Mm-hmm. People say, oh, that's really engineering. It's like, well, all of these calculations are done using mathematics. They could not do this stuff if there was no mathematics.
Right.
And but people think, oh, no, you just math, you just teach. It's like, well, no. And I think that's partly because a lot of the way that mathematics is taught, especially at the lower levels, it's often taught in a way that doesn't reflect the most interesting or creative aspects of it. And therefore people just sort of see math as this sort of laborious and uninteresting topic where, you know, you have to just memorize your times tables when, yeah, you could memorize your timetables, but you could also see patterns in the timetables, like, you know, like multiples of 9 are amazing, right? I mean, the number is always, if you, like, you know, 72, 63, 45, it's always gonna add up to 9. Like yeah. Mathematics is the science and study of patterns. And then sort of describing those patterns in multiple ways and in multiple contexts. But yeah, the fact that people don't realize that cell phone, I mean, all this, the fact that we have more technology as we're going forward in time, and people still are not making the connection that the reason why there's more
all this technological stuff is happening is because math is more central. Maybe people do realize it, because it's definitely true that more jobs now require more mathematics. Mathematics is more important to society. And I think people realize that, but they bemoan it because they're like, oh no, I can't do math, and math is more important to people now, which is unfortunate. And some places, I think, are realizing to try to stay ahead. It's like, oh, since math is more important, we do have to pay more attention to how math is going to be taught at all stages. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's some really problematic social aspects of mathematics that influence this. Like this idea that the faster you can do a series of math problems, the better you are. Real mathematicians have nothing to, there's no race.
There's so much fun in the challenge though.
I mean, the challenge of doing it quickly?
Yeah.
But quickness is not a thing in math, right? Either you get the right answer or you don't. And the fact that it's more important that you can check that you have the right answer than to do the problems quickly and be off. Mm-hmm. And so this notion that sort of speed, and often in lower divisions of education, it's all about how quickly can you do these math problems. And because there's not much, and also this idea that only certain people are good at math, that there's this talent idea. I reject. I think everyone can do math. Math is not a thing that you do, you know, with a pen and pencil, with paper and pencil or chalk and a chalkboard just by yourself. That's not how mathematics is really done 90 something percent of the time. And the fact that people get that impression, it's like, well, I don't want to be that person who just sort of sits in a room and thinks about things that no one else can understand or see, and they're so abstract. When that's not, I mean, most math is done in groups of people working together, sort of grappling with things, and speed is not a thing. Speed is not a thing, and sort of what talent means, I mean, it's not clear. I reject those definitions because I think one could probably say that different people are better suited or do better at different aspects of mathematics. Just because you're really, really good at something, if you can't explain it to anyone else, then what's the point? So how successful you will be in mathematics or in any STEM enterprise not only depends on sort of how well you understand or can produce results in that discipline, but it's also, how well do you work with other people? How well can you communicate your ideas? Mm-hmm. Lots of STEM depends on, because you know it has huge equipment and labs and things. So getting those resources depends on convincing grant makers to support your idea. How do you get someone to support your idea by giving you hundreds and thousands of millions of dollars? You have to communicate your ideas clearly in a way to people who don't necessarily know as much about the concept as you do. So you have to put yourself in their position. You have to use empathy and understanding of how other people will view a subject that they're not familiar with, communicate those ideas, convince them that this thing is really important and that they want to give you money for. And right, as you said, I know that side because the National Science Foundation, that's what the National Science Foundation does. We give out grants to innovative ideas that will align with the mission of the agency. And right, in the part I was at, it was about undergraduate education. So I saw interesting projects that were trying to make education in STEM, mm-hmm. science, technology, engineering, and math, more effective or more interesting. And so, the other problem is that the social stuff is that there are also mathematicians who support the idea that some people have talent, some people don't have talent. And this is obvious why they would do this, because they're mathematicians. So it stokes their ego by saying, oh yes, I'm a mathematician. I have this secret power, this special knowledge that I may or may not allow you to enter into, you know, the priesthood to do math with me. And that's just really a toxic situation, because that just makes reduces the number of people who will want to do mathematics, not increases it.
Right.
We should be looking to increase the number of people who want to do math, not decrease it.
Right. Because then it seems so much less attainable.
Right. But some people see that as a good, as a value. And that's what I'm trying to say, is that one of the things that I try to do in the national mathematics stage is combat that idea that math is this special thing that only certain people can do, and that you have to jump through these hoops in order to be allowed to enter into this particular stage of mathematics. That's craziness. I mean, our goal should be to do more mathematics. The reason why it's also craziness is because if math is this rare, pure thing that only some small group of people do, then why should anyone else care about it? So, I mean, right? It's just gonna become more and more abstruse and less interesting to people. Yeah. And then it's just gonna go away. What I'm talking about is theoretical math. Mm-hmm. Applied mathematics, I think, will always be around, because applied mathematics is actually trying to connect to the real world.
Right.
And that's not saying that I do think pure mathematics or theoretical mathematics is important. Because often, and they also make this argument, is that, oh, well, you don't actually know. Theoretical mathematics is theoretical for a while, and then eventually someone actually realizes, oh, this theoretical mathematical concept has applications to other STEM fields. For example, all, you know, internet commerce, internet encryption, mm-hmm. that's all based on theoretical mathematics that people were doing, you know, in the 70s and 80s, yeah. Or even later now. Now we're doing elliptical curve encryption. That was not no one knew when people were doing mathematics on elliptical curves, they did not realize that in the future, you know, it could be used to, you know, maintain credit card purchases of, you know, Amazon.com or whatever.
Right.
No one knew that. So that's why people say that, oh yeah, theoretical math is also something that should be valued for its own sake.
It's kind of just like any other type of research, right? You have the researchers who, you know, figure out how things work. And then you have the people who apply that in different industries. They take that information and they go and make something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So have you actually seen, or are you seeing, any type of shift in the way that math is put forward to students, given all these realizations?
Slowly, I think. So for example, depends at the different levels. So for example, in college, university level, I think people are aware of this thing called data science, which is, mm-hmm. you know, and this is also part of a bigger trend. It's an interdisciplinary field, a newish interdisciplinary field, where it's a field at the intersection of multiple sort of classical disciplines like mathematics, like computer science, like statistics. Yeah, that's basically data science. And you have data science applied to often, you know, different areas like biology. It's called informatics. And so people do know that data science is a huge thing. You know, Amazon, you know, the three biggies, you know, Google, Amazon, you know, Facebook, they all hire thousands of data scientists per year. And so people are like, oh, what is this data science thing? Oh, what, do you have to do math? Yeah. So people understand that, people understand that math and quantitative understanding of things is more important. For example, in California right now, there's a whole debate going on about how to get more students at different levels interested in math. And one of the things they want to do is eliminate gifted programs, which is, and some mathematicians are very opposed to this because they're like, oh, we have to find a way to identify the students that are going to be more likely to advance further in mathematics. But I am in support of eliminating gifted programs, because often gifted is defined in a way that is really problematic. They're known to sort of be more, people look at certain, the who gets identified as gifted is not just necessarily always based on sort of some objective score on an exam. It can also be sort of who the teacher feels more comfortable with, feels that this person is more likely to go forward. Why did this person more likely to succeed in math than others? Because people who look like this person have more often succeeded in math in the past. So instead, California is trying to make it sort of a more sort of make it a more sort of universal value that everyone should have some particular level of mathematics. I mean, you can make the argument both ways, that by sort of chopping off the upper end or not identifying the upper end, then maybe you're lowering the probability that people will go further the field. So if you make more people interested in mathematics, then you're more likely to find someone who is going to move forward. And the reason why I like the making the group bigger is that even the people who don't necessarily go into mathematics, if everyone had more mathematical knowledge,
right?
Because the reason for, right, because because right now we have this sort of distribution of people. There's some people who know about math and some people who really, really don't want to know anything about math. And that's not a good situation. We want to sort of move the average about of the expected value of how many people know something about math. We want to move it to the right. We want to have more people know at least something about mathematics, because we're going to need those people in the future as the society becomes more quantitatively complicated.
Right. So better distribution of math knowledge is what I'm hearing.
Right. Yes. And that's what California is trying to do by sort of making it more uniform.
Okay. So for our listeners, I know at least a couple students who I've spoken to pretty recently, and they're considering pursuing math. So what are some professions that students like that can consider? I know we've talked about data science, we've talked about the research side, and of course, the academia side, but someone who has a strong knack for the subject or just is really interested, what are some of their options?
Yeah, I mean, mathematics. So one of the areas that I've been doing sort of more research in lately is what's called industrial mathematics. So job categories or things that people can do with math, I think lots of them are not, you know, some places where mathematicians or people who do math work are not necessarily identified as sort of math jobs per se.
Right.
And where that becomes clear is in this area that I call, that lots of other people call too, industrial mathematics. That is mathematics in industry. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of places where math shows up, and it just shows up as a problem. There's a statement of the problem. And this is why mathematics is a language. Often you, in order to state a problem, so for example, I work with people who, you know, work at Chevron or oil companies, and you know, there's specific mathematics that happens there. It might be differential equations, it might be statistics. That's the thing about data. The reason why data science is such a thing is that in our current world, we produce so much data, and data science is about analyzing data to find patterns, to answer questions, to make predictions. And all that involves mathematics. But there's also mathematics in, there's mathematics in carpentry. You know, there's mathematics in designing greeting cards. Mathematics is all over the place. What I would say for someone who's interested in, who feels they have a knack in mathematics, thinks mathematics is cool, is, yeah, just keep on learning more mathematics. And you will see, as you get further along, that there are different connections that these mathematics concepts show up in. So for example, there's a very theoretical discipline in mathematics called topology, which is basically the science of shapes. And no one would think that topology has really much applications to the real world, but you know, everything has shapes. You know, there's topology in how the, you know, shades in cars, you know, how those things get folded and go together. There's topology of how DNA and RNA and biological molecules, you know, connect and how do they link with each other. All of that is mathematics, it's topology. A lot of times these problems are very hard and they need people with different kinds of skills. So yes, you'll need someone who understands the chemistry of how these molecules work together, but you also need a mathematician, perhaps, or someone who knows at least enough math to realize, oh, there's actually a field that will help me understand, you know, how these things go together, how they fold, how they are more likely to, what are the expected shapes of these things? Does that mean, what does an outlier mean? And what's the probability of this happening? And if this happens, does that mean if we do it again, we're more likely to get it? Mathematics shows up in all sorts of ways. It's really a way of viewing the world and helping to explain phenomena. Yeah, so I mean, if you want to know specific job categories, there's websites called wedomath.org or We Use Math. The Mathematical Association of America has lots of information about specific job categories. But those job categories change over time and change rapidly.
Right. Yeah. And I'm definitely getting from you that, you know, it really doesn't matter what you want to get into, math is going to be there. Cool. All right. Well, Ron, what type of advice would you give to someone at a younger age, someone who's a student coming up? I'll phrase this in a way as, what type of advice do you wish you had received at a younger age? And I'll let you pick an age, let's say at 18, 25, or 30.
About progressing in mathematics?
Or about careers, life in general. It doesn't necessarily have to be math specific.
Oh, interesting. I would say, because this, I was at another panel gathering this week. I would say the most important thing I think people can, I wish someone had told me, was realizing that no one does this by themselves or on their own. By this, I mean sort of progressing in a career the way they'd like it to progress, and that one should look for mentors. So a mentor is someone who is further along, maybe not necessarily in the field that you, they might not be exactly where you want to be in the future, but they could be in another area and have more experience in multiple categories. Mm-hmm. And so be very explicit about when you meet people who, you know, take an interest in your future or are doing things that you would be interested in doing in the future, to, you know, talk with them about it and be explicit about, you know, can you help me do what you're doing? Or can you give me information about how you got to where you are? And once you have beginning conversations, to actually be explicit about, you know, can you mentor me? And so to really sort of name and communicate clearly with the kinds of expectations or kinds of professional relationship you would like to have with someone else. Because my mentorship path has sort of been very haphazard and sort of not very explicit. I think I do have some mentors, but I generally have in the past sort of not been explicit about, you know, can you be my mentor? Mm-hmm. Now I sort of am doing that as I sort of try to go from, you know, being an associate dean to being sort of a full dean somewhere, maybe in the future, that I talk to people who are currently sort of deans and say, well, okay, what are the things I need to do? What am I missing? How can you help me? And generally people, you know, are either still professors or not professors yet and want to become associate deans or move into administration. I say, well, these are the kinds of things you might want to think about and recommend them for things, you know. Yeah, so mentors are very important. Mentors help you along your path. Yeah, everyone needs mentors, and everyone should be mentors for the people coming up.
Yeah. And so while we're on that topic, do you have any suggestions for a good way to keep in touch with these mentors? Because I think personally, I struggle with this, and I think a lot of other people do. You may, you know, have like a, let's say a professor or someone you worked with who you really look up to, and you might start that rapport. But then let's say you move on to another job or another school, and it's hard to find ways to stay engaged with that person. What are your thoughts?
I don't think you have to be engaged all the time. I think just checking, I mean, that's why email is a wonderful thing. or you can do calls as well. Or now we actually could like do Zoom calls. But yeah, I think, and you can even talk to the person to figure out what kind of communication works best for them. Some of my mentors, will email every few months or so just to sort of do an update. It's like, hey, this is what I've been up to in the last time we talked. And some even less frequently than that. Yeah, some mentors, I would say might just be email. Some mentors might be phone calls. Some mentors you can go visit hang out with. Depends on the individual mentor and the individual mentoring relationship.
Yeah. Don't overthink it, right?
Yeah, I think you don't need to overthink it.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, Ron, I had such a great time talking to you. So I'm really glad that you were able to make some time for us this morning. And
happy to help Grenadians.
But again, thank you. And to the listeners, thank you for joining us on today's Pathway.